Hello and welcome to Science World. Today we start off with some hopeful news for those who are afraid to smile. Scientists are now saying that someday a laser may help repair damaged human teeth, giving us all a reason to smile. Three new crew members have been rocketed up on another fast-track, six-hour launch-to-docking mission to the International Space Station. We've had several reports in the past about the health dangers of sitting still and the benefits of exercise or even simply increasing motion. Today, we'll hear how sitting less and getting a little more exercise can even help some people who suffer from chronic back, muscle, and joint pain. And according to a new study by scientists at the University of Reading in the UK, Epidocles, an ancient Greek philosopher, may have been onto something back in the 5th century BC when he said that lightning was created in the clouds by the rays of the sun. The British researchers say they've found evidence that lightning strikes on Earth may be triggered by the high-energy particles generated by the sun and sent toward our atmosphere by the powerful solar wind. We'll talk with the study's lead author in our one-on-one segment. These stories and more are coming up for you on VOA Science, Health, and Technology magazine, Science World. Cavities and teeth may someday be repaired using laser therapy. U.S. researchers are using the technology to regrow the tissue inside damaged teeth. Jessica Berman reports.
Since the 1960s, doctors have used laser therapy to repair damaged tissue and destroy unwanted cells. Lasers can be tuned to different wavelengths to remove plaque from coronary arteries, to seal off leaky blood vessels in the eyes of people with diabetes to preserve sight, and to reattach retinas, the light-sensing structure in the back of the eye. Now, Harvard University researchers are using low-power lasers to repair teeth. A bioengineer at the school's Weiss Institute, David Mooney, says scientists aim their laser light for a few minutes on damaged teeth in rats.
We drill through, create this tissue defect, and then we shine a laser onto the defect and through it into this soft tissue that lies underneath the defect. And then we place a temporary filling over that to provide some mechanical protection.
After about 12 weeks, researchers removed the temporary filling and used X-rays to reveal the growth of new bone-like tissue called dentin. The laser light stimulated the regeneration by activating biologically dormant molecules called growth factors. Doctors have used low-level light therapy to activate a number of biological processes, including hair growth and skin repair, without knowing how it worked. In an article in Science Translational Medicine, the Harvard researchers identified transforming growth factor beta-1 as the regenerative protein. Mooney says it's unlikely that whole teeth could be regrown with laser therapy, but he sees two main applications: growing new dentin for people whose teeth are sensitive to hot and cold food and drink, and as an alternative to a root canal. In that procedure, all of the soft tissue inside the tooth is removed to repair decay or damage to the tooth.
So you could replace the lost dentin with reparative dentin, and hopefully then maintain the health of the overall tooth. So that's one application that we would see this being useful in.
Having shown that the treatment is effective in rats, researchers are now planning clinical trials to see whether tooth regeneration can work in humans. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
The International Space Station welcomed three new crew members this past week. Science World's Bob Doty has more.
A Russian Soyuz rocket carrying a multinational crew has arrived at the International Space Station. American astronaut Reid Wiseman, Russian cosmonaut Maksuriev, and German Alexander Gerst of the European Space Agency docked at the ISS early Thursday morning, 6 hours after blasting off from the Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan. 2 hours later, the hatches of both spacecraft were opened, and the trio was heartily greeted by the current ISS crew as they floated into the orbital outpost. Wiseman, Suryev, and Gerst will remain aboard the ISS for 6 months. They will join two Russians and an American who have been at the station since March. The Russian and U.S. space agencies have continued to cooperate despite friction between the two countries over Russia's annexation of Ukraine's Crimea Peninsula. NASA depends on the Russian spacecraft to ferry crews to the space station. For Science World, I'm Bob Doty.
Okay, admit it. We all spend a little too much of our day sitting down and sitting still. Here's something, however, to get us up and walking around. Research confirms its findings over and over that sitting is bad for our health. As Roseanne Skirbel reports, simply standing up and walking more could help make us all feel a lot better.
You can't tell by looking that Michelle Baxter suffers from chronic pain in her muscles and joints. She now spends her workday standing at her desk as a remedy for fibromyalgia.
Since I've been standing, my lower lumbar feels much better, and plus I get to exercise and move more, keep everything circulating in the blood. It feels good.
Baxter works with student records at the George Washington University in the nation's capital. Her switch to a standing desk has given her more energy and made her more productive.
I can get more done. Not even thinking about being stiff and then got to get up and trying to find a place to exercise. So I'm moving. I'm exercising as I'm standing.
And she's burning as many as 1,200 calories a day. That's one reason standing desks are slowly moving into cramped cubicles. Another is research that shows the more you sit, the greater your risk for major illness, says Amanda Visick, an exercise psychologist with the Milken Institute School of Public Health at GW.
It causes poor health outcomes, including overweight, obesity, type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease, hypertension, depression, and even mortality.
As a young woman, Visick developed hip and back pain from sitting. Since she's converted to a standing desk like Baxter, she feels better and has more energy.
I could even work a 10-hour workday and still feel good at the end of the day instead of feeling lethargic and like you just want to go home and then engage in more sedentary activities by laying on the couch.
One study finds that for older adults, every hour spent sitting is linked to a 50% greater risk of becoming disabled. But no one at any age is spared.
So even if we do make it to the gym at the end of the day and we go for a run and do other things, if we spend the majority of our day sitting, right, in sedentary behavior, that is its own independent risk factor. So one is not the remedy for the other.
So if exercise does not compensate for sitting, what does? Visick suggests building activity into your daily routine.
In the workplace, instead of shooting off an email or picking up the phone to call a colleague, you can walk to their office to ask the same question or have the same conversation. When you look for the staircases, they tend to be hidden and out of sight. And so one of the things that we can do is train ourselves when we enter a building to think about staircase first and look for that. So that's an easy substitution for building steps into our day in lieu of riding the elevator up.
The Milken Institute School of Public Health promotes this vision. The central staircase encourages taking the steps. Elevated tables in classrooms and lounge areas provide the option to stand. And all faculty members have standing desks. Michelle Baxter says she takes the long way to the photocopier or to get a cup of coffee. What seems like such a small thing has changed her life and prompted her to offer this advice.
Everybody stand. It's good. It's good for you. Everybody stand. Just for a little while. Try it. Thank y'all.
Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
In a few minutes from now, we'll hear from the lead author of a study that found evidence that lightning flashes are triggered by high-energy particles generated by the sun. So we chose lightning as our topic for this week's Science World Quick Quiz. According to the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, how many lightning flashes are generated throughout the world every second? Is it A, 1 million flashes per second? B, 2,000 flashes per second? C, 300 flashes per second? Or D, 40 flashes per second? Think about it, and good luck. We'll give you the correct answer in just a few minutes from now.
This is Science World on VOA. Be sure to visit our new website and blog at voanews.com/science.
President Obama this week hosted the White House Science Fair, which, once again, featured extraordinary science projects and experiments from some of America's most innovative students. Science World's Doug Bernard tells us more.
The White House Science Fair celebrated student winners from a broad range of science, technology, engineering, and math competitions from across the country. Mr. Obama said they put special emphasis on young women and the work that they did in science projects. He said he's putting an emphasis on encouraging women to pursue degrees in science.
Right now, fewer than one in five bachelor degrees in engineering or computer science are earned by women. Fewer than 3 in 10 workers in science and engineering are women. That means we got half the field, or half our team, we're not even putting on the field. We've got to change those numbers. These are the fields of the future. This is where the good jobs are going to be. And I want America to be home for those jobs.
The president also met with some of the students who created prize-winning projects, such as one young man who created retractable training wheels for children's bicycles, another who created sandbags filled with polymers that expand when they get wet, and a young woman who created a working electric vehicle. The president also announced a new $35 million competition to train math and science graduates and fill more classrooms with math and science students. For Science World, I'm Doug Bernard.
In a world that now holds 7.2 billion people, more than 2 billion of those people are obese. A new study finds that obesity rates for both adults and children are climbing worldwide. But the surprising finding is that the greatest gain in weight is found in developing countries. Jessica Berman returns with this report.
According to the report by international investigators, the number of people carrying extra kilos climbed from 857 million globally in 1980 to more than 2 billion last year. Researchers report 62% of the world's obese individuals live in developing countries. The findings come from an analysis of data gathered from 188 countries in all 21 regions of the world. The study was published in the British medical journal, The Lancet. Investigators discovered the rates of overweight and obesity climbed 28% over the past 33 years. The biggest increase was in children. Almost half of all youngsters and adolescents worldwide are now considered overweight or obese. In developed countries, men have higher rates of obesity than women, although there's evidence that the pace of weight gain in the United States and other Western nations has begun to slow over the past 8 years. Ali Mokhdad is a professor of health metrics and evaluation at the University of Washington and co-author of the study. He blames the easy availability of inexpensive fast food for the obesity pandemic.
Nowadays, food is prepared for us. Remember, in the past, you know, it used to take some time to cook a dish. Now a child, 7, 10 years old, could pop something in a microwave. It's safe and it's readily available. Could open it and eat it.
The authors found some of the highest rates of obesity in China, India, Russia, Egypt, Pakistan, and Indonesia. Places with the highest percentage of overweight people include the sovereign island nation of Tonga, where 50% of the population has a weight problem, along with Libya, Qatar, Micronesia, and Samoa, where more than 50% of women carry excess weight. The healthcare costs of obesity, particularly to developing countries, are enormous, according to Mokhdad.
It has a toll on, you know, our disability, our diseases. And, you know, it was an aging population and we're living longer. No country in the world could afford to spend all the money on treatment. We should find a balance between treatment and prevention.
Without targeted intervention, obesity control programs, and the sustained efforts of national governments, experts say it's unlikely countries will meet the United Nations goal of halting the rise in obesity rates by 2025. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Let's see if you've got the correct answer to this week's quick quiz. A few minutes ago, we asked, according to the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, about how many lightning flashes are generated throughout the world every second? A, 1 million flashes per second? B, 2,000 flashes per second? C, 300 flashes per second? Or D, 40 flashes per second? The answer is D. NOAA says that the old estimate of about 100 flashes per second, which goes back to about 1925, was determined without the benefit of modern weather monitoring equipment. Today, thanks to sophisticated satellite technology such as NASA's Optical Transient Detector and Lightning Imaging Sensor, scientists have been able to determine that there are about 40 lightning flashes generated per second somewhere throughout the world. Thanks for playing along with us on this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week.
Thanks for listening to VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine, Science World. Our new webpage and blog can be found at voanews.com/science.
A group of scientists from the University of Reading's Department of Meteorology recently finished a study that shows lightning strikes on Earth may be triggered by not only cosmic rays, but also energetic solar particles. The British researchers discovered a large and significant increase in the rate of lightning strikes across Europe for up to 40 days after high-energy solar winds have been blown toward Earth from the sun. These energized solar particles that are carried on the solar wind can travel at a rate as high as 1.6 million kilometers per hour. Dr. Chris Scott, an associate professor in space and atmospheric physics at the University of Reading and the lead author of the study, joins us today for our one-on-one segment to talk about what he and his colleagues learned from their research and on ways space weather can impact our own weather here on Earth. First of all, I didn't even realize that cosmic rays had anything to do with lightning on Earth. I always thought it was caused by normal atmospheric conditions. So how do cosmic rays and now energetic particles from the sun trigger lightning strikes?
Well, you're perfectly correct. There has to be an electrical storm building on Earth. You have to have hot air rising and the convective processes within a cloud to rub ice crystals together and generate charge separation. So that all has to be happening, and that you're perfectly correct, that's an atmospheric phenomena. But what is thought to happen is that the cosmic rays, which are very energetic particles from accelerated by supernova explosions elsewhere in the galaxy, these are coming down to our atmosphere all the time, and these provide an instantaneous enhancement to the electrical properties of the air, which enable lightning to be triggered. So, for example, we expect in laboratory experiments to see air, undergo electrical breakdown when you apply a really big electric field to it, and we just don't see that in the atmosphere. So something must be helping seed that lightning, and cosmic rays have long been thought to be the cause of that. What our research has shown is that the sun itself can generate energetic particles, which, while not as energetic as these cosmic rays, they nevertheless are able to penetrate into our atmosphere, and we think that they enhance the lightning process in much the same way.
I take it when we're talking about sun particles sent to Earth, we're talking about solar wind.
Yes, so the solar wind is the continuous expulsion of material from the sun into space. It's a bit like steam rising from a saucepan. It's the most energetic particles in the solar atmosphere that are able to escape and move out into space. But if you think of the sun as a leaky football, it has various different jets of fast and slow solar wind, and these can cause sort of gusts and concentrations in the solar wind. And it's those concentrations that we're interested in, because that concentrates the sun's magnetic field in space, and that simultaneously shields the Earth from cosmic rays because they're deflected by that magnetic field, but also that magnetic field accelerates particles ahead of it in much the same way that a surfer is accelerated by the wave he's riding. And those solar particles are accelerated into the Earth's atmosphere. So we see an increase in lightning when these streams come past, but we also see a reduction in cosmic rays. So it's one process winning out over the other.
What about sun activity such as solar storms, coronal mass ejections, solar flares?
The sun is an active star. It has an 11-year activity cycle, and it has these giant eruptions known as mass ejections that you mentioned. Each one of these is about a billion tons of material traveling at a million miles an hour through space. And these, too, are known to influence the local magnetic field environment around the Earth and to shield the Earth from cosmic rays when they happen. So it's a well-known phenomenon known as a Forbush decrease, where you see a drop in the number of cosmic rays as one of these mass ejections goes past the Earth. So we know that localized enhancements in the solar wind happen, but they actually collide with the Earth relatively infrequently. So to do any kind of statistical test and looking at the lightning as a result of these mass ejections is much more challenging, because although they're bigger events, there's fewer of them.
So in other words, when we're talking about increased solar activity, we're talking about less cosmic rays hitting the Earth?
Yeah. So the Earth is protected by its own magnetic field. But what happens is that you accelerate these particles to such energy that they're actually able to penetrate the Earth's magnetic field and get down into the atmosphere. There is evidence from there's one particular solar storm back in the 1859, which was known as the Carrington event, because it was observed by an English astronomer called Richard Carrington. And that is well known as being the one big mass ejection where they saw something happen on the sun, and a few days later there was lots of aurora and lots of exciting things happened on Earth. And so that's the event that's kind of credited with us being able to link aurora with solar activity. But there's also some work done around the time to show that there was quite a lot of big lightning storms. And so while that's only circumstantial evidence, it may be possible that if you have a particularly energetic mass ejection, that you can have a similar effect.
Now, we have some advanced equipment, instruments in outer space that are specifically studying the sun. And as a result, I guess we're learning a lot more about space weather than we have before. What are we learning about space weather's effect on Earth weather?
This is a very hot topic at the moment, because we have a pretty good understanding of Earth weather. We have a reasonable understanding of space weather. You mentioned we have this fleet of spacecraft in space, and we're able to see these mass ejections coming. We're able to some extent, predict their arrival at Earth. And with the fast solar wind streams that we used in our study, you can actually see those sweeping around, because the sun rotates every 27 days with respect to the Earth. So you can see these things washing past us like the beam of a lighthouse every 27 days. So we can have some understanding of where the interesting and exotic parts of the solar wind are. But as far as weather forecasting is concerned, space weather, we're kind of where weather forecasting was in the 1950s. We have a good understanding of the physics, and we have a good idea of the processes going on, but we're still quite light on observations. We only have maybe three or four spacecraft making observations at any one time. Compared with, obviously, on the ground, we have many meteorological stations, and we now have the advantage of being able to look down on the Earth's atmosphere from space. So we have a much more comprehensive idea of what's going on the ground. And so we're just starting to tease out these secondary signals of how changes in solar weather and activity can be influencing the lower atmosphere.
That was Dr. Chris Scott, an associate professor in space and atmospheric physics at the University of Reading in the United Kingdom. That's it for this edition of Science World. Thanks so much for listening. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. Along with program information, you'll find stories, links, and much more. So stop by and visit us on the internet. The address again is voanews.com/science. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I'm Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us either online or on your radio next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.